coming, despite rains and colds and so on.
Thanks for leaving the talk.
Well, I haven't done it yet. So Antoine gave me this title, which, and I thought of, apologize. I feel I've given this talk too often in the last 9 months, but okay, I'll do it once again, as long as you're willing to come. But it is sort of naive, but it isn't the time to try to do something like that, so let me tell you. Designing nickelates that look like cuprates. The original title has Fermi surfaces, which is sort of, but you won't see that. All right, so for the nickelates that we should talk about has the 6 configuration. So you have one electron and 2 EG orbitals, which are the 3z squared and the x squared minus y squared. And these are Van Leer orbitals, so you can see the 3z squared on the nickel sitting here, and the oxygen p's, pd sigma, it's a lot of oxygen p sitting outside here. My collaborators is Xiaoping Yang, which is in Stuttgart, and Ginyard Kalulin, and I am in Stuttgart, and Carsten Held was in Stuttgart, but he took his group with him and took up a professorship in Vienna. That's where it is. So this is a picture that you've seen many times, the quest for high temperature superconductivity, the TC as a function of year discovery by Kamerling Onnes, and then took 50 years before it was understood, ECS theory, 57. And the materials sort of TCs crept up to, ended up about 23 degrees Kelvin. People were guided at this time by Matthias's rules and other empirical rules. It should be cubic, it should be this, it should be that. And by that, one reached up to about 25 in the A15 compound in niobium-3 germanium. And then, as we all know, 25 years ago, Bednarz and Müller came up with the lanthanum-barium copper oxide, and then the lanthanum-strontium, and then the high TC started superconductivity in a cuprate in materials which did not follow the Matthias's rules at all, ceramics and very different, very bad metals. And the end of that, so at that point, was a few years, well, in April 1993, a triple layer mercury compound was made, and if you put it under pressure, you got it up to 150K. The big thing was when IPCO was made, yttrium barium carboxide, because at that stage the TC max, the TC came above liquid nitrogen. So you don't have to cool it with helium. But then we haven't really come any further since then. So this was a big surprise, and it was against all the rules that this happens, and a lot of experimental activity. And also, you would say, why was it found? Well, Matthias's rules were empirical, and they didn't tell the full truth, at least. Alex Müller's hypothesis of why it should be has not been proved. It's probably wrong, but he found it nevertheless. So this is what usually happens in discoveries in material science, and most of science actually, that you try. Sometimes somebody is lucky. So it was a big surprise, but now nothing much has happened. Then I have made an inset over here. Something happened again in 2002, and this thing is expanded, I mean, from 2 to 10 years is now so much, 10 years was so much. So actually a lot has happened in our times after here. And the first thing that happened, you may say it's not so spectacular, we stay out here, but that magnesium diborite, very simple material, I think you can buy it in the drugstore, but nobody had cared making it properly and taking it down to low temperatures, were fine to superconduct below 40 degree Kelvin, which is higher than any of these guys here. And magnesium diborite is this graphite, basically. So it has boron, and boron makes a honeycomb lattice, and intercalated in the hexagon, so the hexagons sit on top of each other, are these magnesiums. So it's just graphite has 4 electrons per boron in this case, because the magnesium gives its 2 electrons away. So what the heck? We've had intercalated graphites since the 50s and 60s, and they never made it up to more than a Kelvin or something like that. And suddenly this material here. So what was going on? In this case, theory did help because at that time one could do density functional calculations, electron phonon calculations, Gasberg calculations, and within half a year to a year, the situation was cleared up. What happens is that these you have these graphene sheets, and the magnesium in all organic conductors, and in graphite and so on, the conduction electron are the pi electrons, so they go between the stacks, as we have heard the talks about the organic polymers and the organics before. They're all pi electrons. But in this guy, something particular happens, namely that these magnesium 2 plus ions, which sit on either side of a hexagon, has a very attractive potential, of course, for a pi electron. This pi electron, a pz, gets attracted by the magnesium 2 plus, and thereby lowers its energy. So the pi band goes down by about 2 electron volts compared to the sigma bands, and that just takes the Fermi level with it and puts the Fermi level just at the top of the sigma bands. So effectively you get doped sigma holes. So you now have carriers in a band, in the sigma band, which are the strong bonds, the sp2 bonds, and it's simply the electron phonon interaction of those carriers, the sigma holes in this band, because optical stretch vibrations of the honeycomb lattice then makes that. It's a very simple thing, and it's a back of an envelope calculation, because in this case there's really only one phonon, a very few zone-centered phonons which make the action, and a very few electrons just sitting in a tiny cylinder, and it's very easy to do it. So we've understood that fully. There's an added thing. There's also pi electrons. There are 2 gaps and things like that, but this has been understood. Then it was, say, if you can do it with sp2 bonds, so the message is you just have to dope down in the strong bonds. So some Russians actually succeeded in doping diamond sp3 bonds, now 3-dimensional with boron, to the extent that it becomes metallic, and certainly diamond, the girl's best friend, not usually thought about as a metal, becomes a superconductor with a TC of 4 to 5 Kelvin. And then for us it was of course easy to calculate what silicon and germanium would be like, and that came out silicon to be right. But it wasn't very spectacular, and what to do to get higher is not known. So here is a case where we haven't understood very much, I dare say, about what makes a superconductivity. Here's a case where the superconductivity is classical, it's fully understood, it's calculable. Still, it hasn't helped us design any new materials which are electron phonon superconductors, but which go beyond magnesium diboride, which is a shame, you could say, maybe not for us, but what do you think about that? All right, then there was another surprise in the graphite, and these are these orange dots over here. A little later, some heavily electron-doped graphites would mainly be calcium carbon 6. That is again real graphite, but there are calcium in every third hole. So you get 1/3 electron on top of the 4 electrons, so this is really electron-doped, and they were superconductors with about 11 degrees. And again, that was easy to understand. This is now not, this is again electron phonon coupling, but this is now an interband coupling. It is the pi star band which couples to a so-called interlayer band, a free electron like surface band, which sits between the layers, and those two couple heavily, and that is also understood. So again, found by chance, and then the big surprise, as you all know, came 2 years ago again, the pnictites, that you get superconductivity up to about 55 degrees in iron pnictites and then chalcogenides coming like that. This was totally unexpected and it hasn't been understood yet. So designing, what do you mean? All of this has been found by chance. It was full of surprises, and maybe just go and cook and throw stones up in the air and see if a diamond will hit your head someday. But okay, we are paid to do something. Yes.
I have two, or an observation and a general question, maybe for the whole audience, not just for you. I mean, in one sense, not MGB2 per se, but things like that might have been guessed, since one has had the feeling going back many years that it's the divide, you know, the TC scales with the divide frequency, so you want things with light elements, and that's also why carbon is good. Getting a particular compound that actually works is a separate question. But then there is a literature, I don't know, going back 30 or 40 years about maximum TCs out of electron phonon systems.
Yeah.
Does anybody have comments on that literature? I mean, is these solid results? Is this just, is there more to be done in that direction?
Marvin Kuhn is trying. I don't think there are any bounds, any solid bounds on CC for that.
So we should just disregard the papers that say there are solid bounds arising from X, Y, and Z.
I will not say that. I should read them a bit more carefully. But I would not trust any of that, because we've seen so many rules here. And I mean, Phil Anderson wouldn't agree to these bounds either. He wrote one of the papers, as far as I remember. No. I think this thing, as I said, I mean, we have here, I mean, this is very simple, doped down in these bonds, and since the world is full of organic compounds and this and that and hexagons, I mean, why don't you, someday somebody must be able to design something which is at least different, maybe it's not high, but something.
Okay, so that was my question. Once you have MGB2, didn't people try to substitute and theoretically?
Sure, they do, but they boggle, they're always, you know, always fighting the lattice instabilities, of course. And so Pickett and other people, with there was a lithium, maybe boron carbon, yes.
What was the DC on that?
No, nothing, it's an insulator.
Numerically predicted. So
what was predicted numerically?
A similar order of magnitude, even larger, I believe.
But it is not stable.
You
cannot dope it.
We calculate lambdas.
Yes, because I think the road would be now that with all the techniques for making artificial materials, one would try to get rid of those instabilities.
Yes.
And test whether those calculations are correct or not.
Well, but the problem was that experimentally, you know, it's tricky to grow those compounds. Especially if you want to dump.
But the lambda was bigger than MGB2?
Yes.
But
lambda was
big. Sure, you can make that. It's not so hard. I mean, because boron is not so stiff. Boron carbon is stiffer, and you can even make boron nitrogen. And smaller bandwidths and stuff.
Right.
And on. It is just usually you have some instability, so they can't be doped, or I don't know what. Things which I don't think we can simulate yet. We can try. You can get some big computers to.
But Gavin's point is that what seems to kill you both in the theoretical discussions in these old papers on limits of TC, and in practice, is another instability. So you do something that cranks up the electron phonon coupling, and you get some kind of structural instability that puts you in a different phase.
Yes.
So Gabby's question is, can one, by growing multi-layers or God knows what, do something to beat the structural instability?
Yes. I would say, yeah, but I would sort of start at this point and then sort of do perturbation theory around that one and see if you, yeah. I think that's, to some extent, Warren Pickett and other people did some, but I think it was given up. At the moment, it's more like making these big databases, calculate everything on the Earth and screen for this and screen for that.
So the question that when you calculate the lambda, that's a bare electron phonon coupling. That have you also calculated the pseudo repulsive cooling interaction in the list?
Yeah, you can do that with density functional theory. Hardy Gross has a scheme which can do that, so the mu star can sort of be calculated. Yeah, but it is, I mean, the phonon, it is this competing instability, the lattice instability. You have to calculate the phonon spectrum and think about this and that, and then there's only the cooking, whether these compounds then actually form, and yeah.
So
I don't know.
Do you have a good understanding of why the SP2 in MGB2 leads to a much higher TC than the SP3?
Yeah, because you cannot dope them very well. See, this is two-dimensional, and the density of states is a constant as a function of energy. Yes, so you don't have, you just dope it a little bit, and then you have the full density of states. If you do diamond, that is three-dimensional density of states, and you cannot, the crystal breaks again, this, you cannot get more boron into it. It was a big trick to get so much boron into it, a high pressure synthesis or something to get it like that. So of course, if you could dope diamond substantially more and make sure that it doesn't break or anything else happens to it, then yes.
But one should say that among all the superconductors on this slide with a TC larger than 30K, MgB2, at this stage I understand, is the best possible candidate for industrial use, right?
Yeah, yes. So
there is a strong motivation to try to
push. Very simple question. To what extent can theory estimate precisely the critical temperature? Does it say it's between 10 and 100, or it can, I'm curious how good?
No, in this case, I would say if you ask Hardy Gross, I mean, it's within 10 degrees, probably that it's 40 degrees and not 60, let me say it like that. But I mean, usually you're interested in trends, so you sort of sit at some case and then you look around what's a little better, what's a little worse. But of course, it goes into the, you know, it's, yeah.
So is Hardy creating a database?
I don't know. Hardy is not a database man, but maybe some of his people are doing it.
Yes, some people I don't know if he's
I guess so. He has some Italian connection.
There's several people working.
Yeah.
I think the calculations are quite heavy, though.
Yeah, sure, but there are many computers around, and you know, you're looking for extraterrestrial.
Working on that at the moment with three posters takes a long time.
Yeah, but I think you have to get organized somehow. I mean, there are all these data banks and this and that. I know Ole Eriksson in Uppsala is trying to do something, and somebody else. There are people
who are doing that. In Uppsala are also looking at it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what I don't know whether he's using for superconductivity. He would, but he's looking at everything.
I think for the many-body theories, there's some interesting lesson, because that he has some algorithm. To me, the value of that work, if he has some algorithm for extracting new star from a DFT calculation, and that was really the showstopper for the people who were doing many-body theory, because you could take the lambda from the spectrum from an experiment, nobody knew how to get a new star.
Yeah.
So one should know if his prescription for getting a new star, how good really it is.
I thought he actually bypassed that.
No.
He has a different way.
He doesn't want to say that. He has some new star is a well-defined theoretical concept, and his DFT is a way of evaluating it.
I don't think he ever showed this new star.
Of course not, but it's inside.
No, he doesn't talk about that. This is all in the functional, you know. It's.
But if you look at the end of the day, I want to show the final equations. It does look like a middle and the algebra equation with something which does look like a new star, which is computed ab initio. So.
Yes, I would say it the same way here. All right. So what I should talk about today is, after all, trying to see whether we could do something about this. Is there anything else one could do? And for doing that, let me tell you a little bit about the cuprates. So about the trends in the cuprates. So as I said, in the cuprates, there are the lanthanum, strontium, carboxide, and there are, well, these ones are single layer materials. As you get up very high, they have several layers of cuprate layers, but if you at least stay with the single ones to make something similar, you can get from here and up to a single layer. Tellurium, I think, which is up here, mercury, so there's a long span, and the question is any difference that we sort of can quantify. So if you just do density functional calculations for the high TCs, it has been known for quite a long time that there is just one band. In this case, it's an x squared minus y squared. It's the highest antibonding band between x squared minus y squared. And this is a p orbital. So here red is sort of positive. Red is positive, and this is negative, if you like. So this is p antibonding between carbon and oxygen. So it's the highest orbital, and these are layered. They're two-dimensional, so this one is is really high, the other EG one is lying way below. And one can do LDA calculations for those, and it turns out that actually the LDA conduction band, the shapes, and experimental Fermi surfaces as found by ARPES, or by now quantum oscillations, the Hasfanalfin or Amaro experiments, they fit well for the overdoped high temperature superconductor. So in the high temperature superconductors, they start out to be MOT, or at least anti-ferromagnetic insulators. You dope them, and at a doping at around 15%, you get a maximum TC. And this TC max is what I showed you before, and this is what I have drawn up here, which goes up to about 150 Kelvin.
Have you compared your Fermi surfaces with experimental Fermi surfaces?
Sure.
And they all work. So that we can say
all work. I'm an old.
And we can predict the shape of the Fermi surface based on the effort.
For the overdope ones, yes. But the question,
For the overdope, it's good enough.
Yeah. And for the underdope, it seems that the moment you make some, you break the symmetry, some whatever.
But both for whole dope and electron dope in the overdope region, things work.
Yeah, the electron dope. The question is whether you have a spin density wave or something. In the overdope, in the whole overdope ones, this seems to be the case. But I have not done all of them. I've looked at many of them, but I mean, ARPES has its problems with the surfaces, but then there are other experiments, as I say, quantum oscillation experiments, is single layer tellurium. And what we had in the old days in 1991, yes, we did IPCO, and nobody believed it, and so on and so forth, but it's all come through. So things which 20 years later gets accepted, and they find all these things, although the dopings and the surface may charge a little bit, but it's all there. So that makes me very confident about that. But maybe I'm more confident than others.
May I just press you on that point? I think you're probably going to come back to this. But there is, at least the way I think of it, a parameter in the band structure, which comes from, let's say, details of specifics of crystal structure and so on, which basically tells you where to put the Van Hove singularity.
You can say that.
To other parts.
Oh, this band shape, yeah.
So how much difference does changing that parameter, for example, your R from 0 to 0.4, make for the actual shape of the Fermi surface if I look at an overdope material, doping 0.5?
Okay. I should have shown that, yeah. But it shows, so for I equal to 0, you know it is a square, it's a checkerboard, if it's half full. So the Fermi, so we are talking, so the trend that you find when you do LDA calculations for all these materials where you know experimentally where the atoms are, and if you sort of try to extract the message or the thing, then you get that the conduction band changes like this, and then the big surprise is that as a function of this change, the TC max seems to go up. I can get back to this. So now the question is, how much is this change? So this is this extracted Vanier function type band, and I should also say the Vanier functions for this R value of 0.17 is this guy here, and the Vanier function of the Mercury guy is something which is up here. So
that's next year's names.
Sorry?
Nearest neighbor Hawking relative to...
Yeah, it's in the first, it's a power expansion, but in the roughest approximation, it's T prime over T. So you have your Kappa lattice here, and there, and there, and there, and there's a Hawking integral from here to there called T, and this thing is T prime. And this R in the lowest order is T prime over T, simply. So it is how to hop from there to there. Okay, so...
I didn't understand the answer to the question.
No, I'm coming to...
Okay,
sure. Sorry. No, I'm not in the talk at all yet, but it's fine. So if you take I equal to 0, T prime is 0, yes, then this band is electron hole symmetric. So this part is you stand on the head, and it's the same as that part here. So this Fermi, so if you put the Fermi level at the Van Hove at half filling, this is a checkerboard. It's a square Fermi surface, which is 1-1 oriented. So it's like that. As you go over here, it turns and becomes 1-0 oriented. Of course, if you put it through here, well, then the volume changes and so on and so forth. But this trend is a turning of the Fermi surface from having flat pieces along 1-1 to having its flat pieces along 1-0.
And again, so if I compare just dopings of 0.25, let's say, not half filling, where there are obviously big differences if the Van Hove singularity is not there, but it's somewhat lower dopings, just how different are the shapes of the Fermi surface?
They're different because you see already over here, you go through the Van Hove if you do whole doping. But all the other ones, which basically are sitting on this side, above in electron scale, above the Van Hove singularity.
So I understand you can tell the difference between r equals 0 and 0.1, 0.3, 0.4. Can the experiments tell the difference between 0.1 and 0.4 at the present state of the art?
Yeah, I had a picture, I mean, CX, but I don't know whether he ever published it. They took the APIS experiment and they made not calculated as out here, but measuring off. You just measure the Fermi surface. There's a very, you just measure a few calibers and you take the ratio or something and then you have the R. So this model which makes this fits well and it does that. But there are also other parameters, maybe I should say. I mean, well, one thing I would say, there's this in IPCO, which is the most complicated one, but it's the one which is stoichiometrically dope and which you could do. There are that these saddle points bifurcate because of the planes dimple and this and that. The parameter doing something to that doesn't seem to have any influence on in this graph here. The also in the graph, I then showed these experimental ones, and this low one here, this is KZ dispersion. Some of them has a huge KZ dispersion. So you would say here, so this is a two-dimensional band structure. If you have KZ dispersion, this shape would change whether you are KZ at the zone boundary or in the middle, and it can be as much as there. But this one, it's not. It depends on whether it's stacked on top of each other. It's like this and that. This is this one here. And then you can see there are some which has two, say, IPCO, single layer mercury, because there are two planes. And then the bonding and the antibonding sheet of those copper will be, that's the bonding and that's the antibonding, give you 2 points. If you have triple layers, it will sit up like that. And if you believe any of this plot, then the black dots, which is the bonding ones, do sort of correlate with the TC max, but not this one. And you might have believed that this one would do it because that's the one which sits close to the Van Hove singularity. This one does not. It's one of the things coming out. Okay, so together with this band goes these Wannier functions in LDA, and you can see these are big objects. That's just a one band thing for this. It's not something you would like to use with a single, with a Hubbard U, because if you take this orbital and you translate and put it here, you can see there's a lot of Coulomb interaction between them, even if you sit here. But anyhow, that's what they look like. So the chemical trend, you can see what happens as this goes, is that this orbital spreads out in the plane. And it spreads out in the plane because it contracts perpendicular to the plane. So what is the geometrical thing which controls this has to do with the apical oxygen which sits out here. So this guy actually has some sticks, an axial orbital I call it, which stick out here, which in this case over here has disappeared. So it's a geometrical thing. Okay, and this has the, so what structural elements determine that? So this is now this Wannier function for, single band Wannier function for the Lancelot cuprate. So this is a plane. So this is cut in the side, x squared minus y squared, then antibonding to this oxygen P. And then the backside of this oxygen P has all this chemistry, which sits here and which is a controlling one. So it goes to copper here, and it hybridizes a bit with copper 3z squared. And then there's a big diffuse one which you can hardly see, but there's actually copper 4s. Copper 4s is a blue stuff which you can imagine sitting all the way here. It's very diffuse, but it's mostly actually copper 4s. And then that's antibonding up to this apical oxygen which sits here, and even going on depends what sits out here, whether it's lanthanum or bismuth or whatever you can have into the cation sitting here. So this is what happens in that. And the way we now describe this trend, so the materials trend is best understood in terms of a tight binding model, if you like, the two orbitals, not this one, but let's break it up into two. And the one is this one, let's say the copper dressed by the oxygens in the plane. And the other one, copper dressed with the oxygen in the plane. And the other one is this guy, which I call the axial orbital. So that is an orbital which, so this one is x squared minus y squared in the plane, but this one is round. So this is copper S, 4S, dressed with copper 3Z squared minus 1, apical oxygen Z, and lanthanum 3Z squared, and so on outside here. And the materials dependent parameter is the energy of this orbital with respect to the Fermi energy. this R parameter, just another way of writing it is you can think of it as this energy is the, sort of a cover for its excited orbital, but dressed with all this stuff. And the lower this guy is, the higher is TC max. The bigger is T prime. And the point is that in order to hop around the corner, you have to hop onto this orbital, basically, but I won't show you that. So the energy of this orbital, the actual orbital, so what I end up is it has some energy here, and it lies somewhere above the Fermi level. And the closer this one comes to the Fermi level, apparently the higher is the R. I don't know why TC max is higher, but that's what you figure out.
If I work with these two orbitals, I will have one combination of these two that I will need to use to construct the single band that you were drawing before.
Right.
And then there is some other combination that builds up another band.
Yeah.
And which band is that? I mean,
I will show you. That's the SP excited S band. But that thing is because so hybrid, it's fractionated. You don't see it in a band structure where you have millions of bands. Yes. So this is sort of extracted. So this axial orbital is that linear combination. That it is this component of the Wannier function, if you like. If you look up there, there is not such a band because there are many other bands with which it hybridizes.
So in other words, if I'm going to write a simple tie band model,
the 2x2
involving two orbitals, I'm going to have one of the two bands that reproduce nicely.
Right, I'll show you the picture. Yes. So when we come to the nickel age, this will of course be 3z squared for nickel, yes. Yeah. So it's an x squared, m equals to 2 and an m equals to 1 guy. And I'm just saying in the chemistry, so this tells you what is this thing, and that of course depends on, so first you hybridize, so there are 5 orbitals, yes, this one with that one, and then in the end it's apical oxygen to carbon, yes, and if this thing, and if, let's say, apical oxygen, let's say the lanthanum, this hopping interval is big for lanthanum because it's close. And that means that this thing is big, and this means that this repulsion is big, and therefore the epsilon S, the R value for lanthanum is small. But if you were pulling it further and further away, as you were having with mercury, then that thing would finally end up here. There would be no hopping interval, there would be no hybridization between this and that thing would end here. So that's why RT prime is bigger for single layer mercury. And the big surprise now, to me at least, we just wanted to see the single layer materials, is that the double and triple layer materials fitted into the plot. So why is that? And the chemical reason for why it does is simply if you stay with a single layer, if you now have a double layer, this thing of course breaks up into bonding and antibonding. So the point is that this actual orbital comes from here. It determines the hopping in the plane, but it certainly is the vehicle for hopping out of the plane. Yes, so it has a dual role. If you're having a second layer upside up here, to get out of the plane, you get onto this orbital and hop out of it. So it's sort of a crucial thing. So if you had a double layer, this thing would split up and down. You would have an antibonding and a bonding level. And the bonding is closest to the Fermi level. And this was the big surprise, that the bonding one, where the Fermi surface is least complicated, it's fairly dull looking, fitted in, and the reason why it does it, and this one is closest to that. Then you could say, well, let's make more and more and more layers, and people have certainly done that experimentally, but after 3 layers, you don't get any enhancement of TC, presumably why the coherence goes, you can't make it, I guess, I don't know. But anyhow. So this was the system.
So the question, so here, where does the tx squared minus y squared orbital locate the energy location?
Oh, this one is what I call Fermi level here. Sorry. So this comes from the other side. This picture just show you how to calculate the energy of this orbital. Because this orbital is composed of apical oxygen Z, of copper 3Z squared, and of lanthanum and copper S, and that's just the way I couple them up to show you. So from this one you can learn what happens, say, if I change the distance to apical oxygen, or if instead of lanthanum I put bismuth where this thing goes down, then you can also see whether it's good or it's bad for this R parameter. So back to this picture again. Now I put the side view of the orbitals you saw before that they were spreading out in the plane. Now you can see perpendicular, you can see this is what I showed you before in the plane. And you can see for the lanthanum here is this apical oxygen which it binds to. So the picture I just showed you was just a contour plot of this picture here. But you can see if you go to a single layer high C1, there's nothing here. And this oxygen X squared minus Y squared, this oxygen here is mostly out here, it's mostly copper S and maybe even some copper 4P, whereas here this thing has its 3Z square sitting in here, and it's not like that.
So the same material can have two different ratios of heat drive and heat because you look at four bonding and anti-bonding orbitals.
This thing is a single layer material, two single layer material. This is single layer and that is single layer. This one has a low TC max, this has a high. These two have different dispersion. The dispersion of the conduction band of this guy is somewhere up here, and the dispersion of this one is somewhere down right here.
How the same material can have different Tipra
Oh, this is a double layer, so they are different. This point, the R, T prime over T is for, there are two bands. If you have a double layer, there's two bands. And in band theory, they would come as bonding and antibonding, if you couple them, if you could see them, yes.
For lanthanum, you put just one.
No, for this one, this is a double layer material. This is double layer mercury, and this is the bonding sheet has this dispersion, and the antibonding has this sheet. Oh, but you can have a triple layer material here. So these are all different materials. And this is a triple layer mercury, no, a triple layer tellurium. So there's the bonding, the non-bonding, and the antibonding sheet.
And so the bonding one you're saying is striking TC.
Yeah. Strength.
Is it correlates with in any form with the special structure of axial orbital you showed in the previous slide? Does it get more strength?
Yeah. The axial orbital I showed you for a single layer material. If you have a double layer, this picture I don't have it. If you have a double layer material, there's no axial, there's no oxygen in the middle. Yes, there's just yttrium or barium, something, calcium. But then in order to hop from one layer to the other, you have to get onto the copper 4S. So that's the point. So again, this R parameter is really the round, the copper 4S, or the actual character. So, So that's why this splitting also depends on R. So in order to do the hopping between this band and that band, that hopping is a hopping integral from copper 4s in one plane to copper 4s in the other plane. So it's proportional to copper 4s character, and that's what makes this a splitting.
But a little simple structural thing, if I look at the in the outcome of your linear function, if I look at the side of the axial orbital out of plane, can I calculate it with the R?
Sure, because I mean it is normalized. So in this, so yeah, I should have brought more. Actually, this is about nickelate. So sorry, but if you see this one here, you see a lot of stuff. If I had done the same picture now for this material over here with the high TC, then you would basically have seen nothing here. Because this, in that case, the geometry is that the apical oxygen is sitting all the way up here. So there's very little hopping, coupling from this guy to the copper S. So for that material, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. And since you have to normalize it to one, there's a lot in the plane. So what happens as you go from a low R to a high, in a low R, you have this one, and it is fairly condensed in the plane, and it has these sticks out. Whereas this guy up here, the sticks out, the feelers out collapse, they're not there, and it spreads out in the plane. And that's probably why it's good for superconductivity, maybe, because it's concentrated in the plane.
What's the typical order of magnitude of epsilon S minus epsilon F?
You'll see a picture. Okay, so one thing, let me just say this also. So what is the difference between these, just to quantify this? So what happens is, here these are going from, what do you call it, 0, 0, pi, 0, pi, pi, and back. So I'm going, the Brewing zone is a square, and you go along an edge, and then you go up on the other edge, so you go out here, and you go up, and then you go back along the diagonal. Along the diagonal from M to gamma, these bands are all the same. Nothing happens, there's no difference. What happens is that the saddle point sits lower and lower. Here it sat in the middle, as I said, but as you put this R prime, pushes this saddle point further and further down, so this foot becomes more and more flat. Why is that? Why is it that this trend in the bands are caused by the bimixing of this actual orbital?
So that's what the next picture shows.
And the picture now shows you a block function taking at this point pi half, which is in the middle of here where nothing should happen, and it takes one here at the saddle point at pi zero. So here's now a picture of, as I said, I've now broken the orbitals up to the two, that is the copper x squared minus y squared and the oxygens, and then the oxygen, that was the one I had on the left side, that is the other orbital. And now I make a block wave out of those orbitals, and I make a block wave which has a k vector here, which is pi half. So this one is antibonding here, and now I have to translate it, let's say, over to this point. And this is perpendicular to the block vector, so as you go from here to there, you have the same sign. So this one has the same sign here, the same sign here. If I go out here, I'm going to have a plus here and a minus here, and I have a node at this point here. So this is a block wave made out of the Drist x squared minus y squared. If I made it out of the actual orbital, which is round, this block wave is plus here, zero here, minus there. Now see if they can hybridize with each other. So let's put this one on top of that one and see if they talk to each other. So they do the hopping between them. And this one is round, so you have to hop from this one to this oxygen. It's minus, but here it's plus, and it's plus. So they have different symmetries. This one does not hybridize with that one. And that's what this picture said, that at this point, nothing happens. They're the same, they're not influenced by the apical. But if you go and take a k vector at the pi zero point, at the saddle point, now the k vector is here, so I have my copper and the oxygen, so I have this antibonding thing here, and now I translate it, if I go here, I change the sign, so this is sort of cross, not cross-hatched, and that's cross-hatched, so I change the sign with the wave going from here to there, but if I go perpendicular to k, nothing happens, so there's nothing on these oxygens, these are oxygens, so it looks like that. But if I do the same with the actual orbital, it's of course a wave going plus, minus, and if I go here, nothing happens. Now try to put this one on top of that one and ask whether they can hybridize, and then you have a cross hatch, but it goes with minus, minus. So there is hybridization between these two. So you have maximum hybridization for the saddle point and minimum at the pi half, and it turns out this hybridization goes as cosine minus cosine squared.
So this is basically why you see C-axis current matrix element at that sort of form factor.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this basic thing is one of the most important sort of symmetries sort of the, you know, one electron level of the high CCs.
So the question
here,
the hybridization between the 3D x squared minus y squared and the 4x mostly come from the different copper sites, right? On the same site, the hybridization is small, right? From the atomic picture.
Yeah, you're going to overlap on that to D0.
I mean, the orbitals I'm talking about here is atom-centered. You could say, well, they are Van Leer functions, but they're atom-centered. Now I've made block waves out of them. But what I'm trying to explain here is simple symmetry arguments. So the only thing I'm telling which they don't mix and they mix, and the only other important thing is what is the energy of this guy, of this whole stick, of this whole hybrid, compared to the other one. So here now are your two bands drawn in the schematic thing. So well, these are bad pictures. I'm sorry, I've been criticized for that. But anyhow, in this lanthanum thing, so here is our conduction band, and x squared minus y squared from now on is black, and the actual orbital is yellow, the character, and this excited band, the epsilon s, that band looks like that. So it started out with a level, and then they hybridize, and then they do that like that. And they hybridize apart. Out here, there's no hybridization, so they are the same. But if you come to this guy, then it looks more like that. So here they have hybridized a lot, and it's like this and like that.
So there is a huge decrease of these.
Yeah. But these are effective parameters. I mean, these are things which you take out with green fingers. Yes. But yes. Yes, yes, yes. So these were the band structures of the known family of light. You see, cuprates, can we engineer them? Okay. And so Gignac had this idea some years ago, later he said, let's try, couldn't we do it with nickelates? I mean, so in cuprates, you would say, yeah, I have this great trend, didn't it help me, like magnesium diboride, so why don't we get on and make some other cuprates, which are even better than two-layer mercury? But
my thought was too late, you know, everything was known at that stage. I actually used the structures of all these cuprates, and there was nothing wrong with the basic. You can do, you know, you can get put in more layers, but then you can do something else, which is rather this kind of thing. So here I say, why can't you do it with these cells? So make a 3 plus. And the idea is to sandwich them, because there's a new technology here. It's now possible to make hetero structures with high precision, say, with pulsed laser deposition of a perovskite like these. So you could try to make man-made things. So you could take these guys, this nickelate, lanthanum nickelate, and you could sandwich it with an insulator, so that you could find the things to be two-dimensional. That will break the symmetry between the x squared minus y squared and the 3z squared, which you otherwise had here. And by doing that, so you would say the confinement together with the electronic relationship that make it possible to uncollide or empty the 3z squared, and thus leaving the conduction electron, that is the seventh electron in that band. So you want to get rid of the 3z squared. So if the 3z squared can be manipulated to lie above x squared minus y squared, it might then play the role of the actual orbital, this round, in the cuprate. And you'll see that now we enter this diagram from the other side. And then, of course, all sorts of things can, of course, unfortunately happen. You can get other competing phases, and the charge is proportionation is one, and many other things can happen.
I'm sorry, I realize this is off your topic. Can I just ask, does anybody understand this charge disproportionation? The experimental literature claims that this very plainly happens in the nickelates, in the bulk, you know, perovskite-type nickelates. But it's hard to understand if your picture is basically of a repulsive U which wants to disfavor charge disproportionation. Does anybody know where it comes from?
Well, I can only
Is there, I mean, is there a concrete theory? Is there a paper that...
No, there's a massing constant paper, I guess, from it, and they simply say that, of course, J likes charge disproportionation. So typing, if you have D7, then you would like to have D6 on this side, two different sides, D6 on one side and D8 on the other side. So the two electrons would...
Oh, so it's just that J is so big that U minus 2J is effect, or whatever it is effectively...
Yeah, but it's a little hard to think why J should win over U.
Okay.
And then it plays together with lattice results, the oxygen goes in and out. And I can show you a calculation, we get it, but yeah, I agree with it.
I don't understand why the has to be above or below. I thought all you're using is level repulsion, right?
No. Now we have two layers. We didn't have the cuprates, you have D9.
Yeah, but this is just one electron theory, so what does it matter?
That's where it goes. I mean, one is above or below the other. We want an x squared. We believe that we would like an x squared minus, the electrons to be an x squared minus.
Yes. Right.
Right. So we need
So this is not to increase the prime.
This is field C2G. Yes.
So this is not to increase the prime. This is just to put the square minus pi square and occupy the
orbital. This is something which comes on later. So annealing is to this.
Okay.
And how you get rid of it is by confinement, and then anybody will help you, or so on and so forth. Yes.
And why D7 and not D9? I mean, isn't it better just to try to make nickel D9 and to mimic the coup rates?
There's a paper from 99 with the Morris Rice and
And what's the conclusion?
You can't make any of it. But they just took that pulse, basically. Maybe you can't make any of it. I'll get that to you.
Okay. I can show you a counterexample.
Okay. So let me just...
This whole thing about the needle, why not take a cuprate and do what Bodrich is doing? Just lay out one layer of copper oxides and forget about the Kipperb suppressed. The other plane orbital by putting some insulating layer. Why do we need to go to Nikolai?
Maybe not. I mean, this was clear. I mean, they made, I mean, we are technology, sorry, Kaima and Havala, I believe we could do really important measuring. So, Khalil and Alonso, we can be trying to develop it and so on. But I don't know, but the single layer didn't let me get to the point. In the cuprate, the single layer mercury and the single layer thallium, essentially, you are as far as you cannot drive this R value any higher because apical oxygen is infinitely far away. It doesn't exist there. Then you can say, and you want that other thing, and you don't want to have the infinite layer system which people look at sometimes because then you have a lot of perpendicular copper optical, and that you don't want. So I would say, well, as far as you can get, the only way to get higher from single layer mercury or thallium is to make multi-layer. So you're going to make double layer mercury, that's what the picture. And that helps because then you split and you get a bonding and the antibonding. And the bonding one is lower. So you make more layers. That increases TC max, but it has a limited clearance. So you cannot go beyond three layers. Then again, TC goes down. And why? For sumo, because we lose the coherence across the layer.
So you believe that the ingredients are you want to have a gear for my slice for the plane?
And we want to do something else to say it, and I'll explain sort of the logic so why. So Kaliulin, I mean, they could be, and Kaliulin said, well, let's look at it again, why Ryzen and Nisimov and all of that, that was in the days where you know we have bolts, and but now you have new materials, so let's see. So I'm just now just explaining this confinement. So let me start out with a cubic. It is actually, it's a lanthanum nickeling. It's a D7 bulk compound, and it's almost cubic. And in this material here, I made it cubic. So it's cubic, then the two orbitals, the x squared minus y squared, and the 3z squared are detailed. And now I just plot out. So here is this material. There are two unit cells actually. So it's a light cuprate, a nickel layer of nickel, oxygen 2, nickel on a square lattice connected to the oxygens. And here's the next one up here. And in between is a layer of lanthanum oxygen. So it's a layer of LaO and a layer of NiO2. And it goes on. So what is the band structure of this guy? In human, but just this EG band structure is like this. So here is a brewing zone, it's a cube. And if I first go out, take this path out here. So I'm sitting in this 1-1 or 1-1-0 plane. And this plane, you remember the round orbital, the actual orbital, and the x square minus y square orbital don't hybridize. That's what I showed you. Let's pick them up with that. So in this case, you get two bands, a black one, which is purely x square minus y square, that's black, and a green one, which is purely, as we said, squared. And how do they disperse? Yeah, they are degenerate, so you could have taken any linear combination of them, you would have had the same, but for those lines, I chose the directions, I choose the corresponding axis for the orbital. All right, so the 3z squared starts off at this point here. Then we go out in the plane, there's not much dispersion because this one just hops to the next one by the belts of the orbital, and the hopping interval from this point to that is square root 3 and this and that. So there's not much hopping here. But then you go from here and you go up, and then there's a lot of dispersion because this one, of course, hops up to the one above and below, so it disperses from here. And then we go back again, and we here now I stay out in the plane, nothing much happens, this one looks like that one, and then finally you're up here, and you go back again, and you lose all the dispersion. The x squared minus y squared, you go out in the plane first, and that's of course, you put this one over here, so there's a lot of hopping from here to there, so again, all the hopping in the plane, if you don't go perpendicular to the plane, nothing happens, and it comes down again. So the bottom and the top are the same, the two orbitals are identical, but that's what they look like here. Now we can try to do another pass. Let me try to do this one here. So I go up here, but now I go out in this plane. So this plane is now the same as the plane where we did the plots for this Rmax thing from the saddle point from gamma to x to and so on. So that's what we're going to do. We're going from here to there to there. So I go from So I first now go up a little bit and I explain why, and then I go out in the plane with half. So I first go up a little bit, so that's like going here and I go up to half, and up to this point here. So the 3z squared takes off, x squared minus y squared gets nothing by going out in the plane. And now I go here from what you call gamma to m. So this one is now in the plane. This one, the thing does like that. And this one does like that. And then they go on. So here they hybridize. Now remember, I'm outside of this plane. I've now gone like this. So these x3z squared and x squared minus y squared hybridize. So this picture looks basically what you had before. The black part of it is sort of the x squared minus y squared, and this one is the axial orbital, that is the 3z squared, if you do it.
It is just
that this yellow one, which in the cuprates used to sit way up here, is now degenerate in this bulk thing and sits down here. If instead I go up to the zone boundary here, and I go out, then I continue going on here.
See, I go up, so I've just taken this one
and break it and went into the plane. Now I go from here and up. So here I go from here and up. You get this part if you go out here. So this is where I choose the top.
Now, this is the bulk thing for this,
where they are degenerate.
But now if I can insulate, put some insulating layers here, I will put
lanthanum aluminate here. Then I would, in poor man's theory,
be putting a node in my block function.
My block function, let's say this is nickel, but this is aluminum, this is aluminum, and this is an insulator. Then the block function will have a node here. There cannot be any block functions with long wavelengths in the KC direction down here, because they have to go to zero at the insulator layer, if you can do that. So the longest wavelength guy you have is basically this. So that corresponds to this one. So if you could do this confinement, the band structure you would get out just by cutting is if you can only take it here, so you will get up with one which looks like that. Or maybe you could shift the node a little bit by changing the chemistry. You could change the node of this lid, and maybe you would say all of this is forbidden, you have to get out here.
Then
get to that. So you can see this confinement now makes these two degenerate. These two are no more degenerate. Because here the 3z squared really has been pushed up. And if this is the Fermi level as it is, in this case with 7 electrons, you can see that this confinement pushes the 3z squared almost out, up, and becomes unoccupied. And now real or LDA calculations are surprising like this. So this now is a real LDA calculation. Where we have this nickel aluminum put aluminum on other sides of it, and we have relaxed the shelving, has relaxed the distances and so on and so forth. And this is what this single layer lanthanum, nickel aluminum with single layer lanthanum aluminate structure looks like. And you will say, this is actually surprising how well it fits with this ring. And you can do another one, and I can argue why. You can, instead of aluminum, put scandium.
it's good instead of lanthanum. We have this prosium. This is because you can buy these materials. But scandium is important, and you actually get to something. So you can fiddle it. You have chemical control of how you can do that. And these are now real bands, so something should be coming in. So there is this comfortable gap of 2 or 3 volts in which these paramagnetic calculated EG bands lie. Below here, this is the negative C2G bands, of course, together with the oxygen 2P, and the bonding part of the aluminum 4S. That is the valence band, the conduction band with metal 4S, the lanthanum 5B, the aluminum 4S, again, antibonding to oxygen. So there's a lot of LDA covalency. This gap is ionic, you would say, but it's certainly partly covalent. And if you make the difference with scandium, it's actually not there. Coming here now, you can see all the little bigger, it's the scandium 3D in particular. So you have these two bands lying comfortably in this gap between the others, and that sort of thing could motivate. Let's look at it and see what correlations will do to it in this approximation. And we could only do one atom per cell. So the same with charge distribution of this and that was done on the mean field and the LDA plus U level. But let me first see what can. The first thing that you should notice now, let me get back to this, that for this lanthanum thing, you will see that here is a piece of Fermi surface at this point, I should say. This is along the gamma line, so they don't hybridize here. And they don't hybridize here. So this is purely 3Z square like. And there is a little 3Z square pocket below the Fermi level. But not, well, at the gamma point, out of this set point, it's not very much. This band is the one which is the x squared minus y squared. And you can see the Fermi surface of this, if you look at it, looks pretty much like the high CC Fermi surfaces. This is x squared minus y. If you get to this with chemical modification, you can see by putting in scandium, we can push this even further. And at this point, you almost got nearly the sky. So it is pretty much x squared minus y squared. And now I go back to this R thing and this two band theory before. You can easily show that the R value, which corresponds to the actual orbital leaving the Fermi level, sitting at the Fermi level, is R 1/2. So that is a magical number. I don't know whether you remember all these pictures, or I can get them fast. But
R 1/2 is here. So what you're doing with the nickel H, you're coming from the other side. Now the 3Z squared is the actual orbital. It doesn't come from above, it comes from below. The real nickel H, you're sitting up here and you have two sheets of the Fermi surface. It doesn't look like a good break at all.
But if you can shift it so that you only get a one sheet of the Fermi surface, you get rid of one band, then at the point where one band leaves, you design to 1/2. And you hope now to modify, you could shift it up, then you could see that in this part of the diagram. As regards the shape of the Fermi surface, there are other things which may be very different than probably are, but that's one.
Yes. So this chemical control is powerful. Where do you
relax this? How do you relax both in plane and out of plane?
Yeah. But not fully freely.
Yes, but what you didn't consider many of the experimental systems are grown on substrates, which will
increase the implant. We put it on strontium titanate. I'm sure we won't.
But that means that the implant is not relaxed, or it is?
The implant was not relaxed. They were kept at the
So in that one, in the previous one, it was basically relaxed only out of plane, right, enslaved to the implant.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
At this 1.95 in strontium titanium, and only this one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we have one where we now put it on some other substrate, but it's padding. This is just to remind you what these fat bands now we are not. This should have been, if you like, this thing used to be yellow, the fat is here, and this thing is black. But just so I'm comparing a cuprate to the single layer lanthanum aluminate. And in the cuprate, we remember we had the single x squared minus y squared band, 3z squared was full and sitting down here. And the distance to apical oxygen is far because 3z squared is full you fill the antibonding level, there's no bond to the apical. So by filling this, you have a huge octahedral very extended. But that's a cuprate situation. In the megalate situation, D7, you have an almost empty 3z². So the octahedral are almost perfect. Apical oxygen have come in and have pushed this 3z² level up to here. So 3z² is now partly empty. And therefore, the distance to apical oxygen is like that. And the two bands we're talking about are Islanzi moments, this one and that, and I'm just talking about, and maybe we could get rid of this stuff, and then the nose band, which is partly 3z², also would look like a cuprate band with a very high value bar. But the value function, if I took it at this band alone, would of course stick more out than the corresponding value function for the R value over here. So, because it's a different, this one has more, much more 3z² character than it had in the cuprate. So the character of the actual orbital is different. In the cuprate, it's mostly called 4s. Here, it is mostly 3z². That is probably a few seconds.
But what I'm just confused about, when you were talking about the two orbital description for the cuprates, the other orbital was lying above terminal, right?
The two orbitals that we get out in the variation vector of this one and that one.
And that's for the megalate, right?
Yeah. And the cuprate all on this one.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that increases the prime, the proximity of that level?
Yeah, because in this model you can think of this four as one. This seems to be the oxygen orbitals and h square minus y square and the axial. And now I only have nearest neighbor hop, and I never hop from comma to comma. So if I want to go from hop from this comma to that and over to this one in the square, then so I go from this comma to that comma, that's fine, that goes via oxygen here. But in the nearest neighbor model, if it's x square minus y squared, I want to hop directly like that. In order to hop there, you have to hop onto a round orbital in order to hop around the corner. So the epsilon is the excitation energy of the actual orbital is the one you have to hit in order to get around the corner. It's also the one you have to hit in order to get out of the plane. So here we stretch the substrate a bit. So if you titanate, release from some titanate, and if you stretch it, you would of course believe that by stretching it here, you get apical oxygen further down, because if you stretch it here, you contract it here. And you want to get apical oxygen down because you want to push the 3z² up, and since this is antibonding, you like to get it up. But that's not quite right, because right at the gamma point, this thing is purely 3z², like it doesn't speak to oxygen at all. The only reason it speaks a little bit, you can see a little bit happen, not much happens, a little bit happens, because this part was sort of, remember the confinement, you're half out in the burning zone, you're pi over C half, you're not a pi over C, so a little bit happens here, but it is just via this oxygen which sits here. So, yeah.
I'm sorry. I missed that point. I thought that at the gamma point, the splitting between the black and the yellow orbital was entirely a confinement effect, and the magnitude was entirely the hybridization between the nickel and
the black. There were various gamma points. So gamma, they're all kx equal to ky equals 0. So it's gamma in the plane.
Yes.
But now we go perpendicular.
Right, that's the difference between gamma and z, right, in your picture.
This one is C, it's a planar description. So I think the meaning of the gamma and the C are changing because of, yeah, that's the way people do burn something. I'm sorry. Yeah, this is
confusing.
That's why I
made. But let me go back to the physics question and leaving aside notation just for a second. I thought that just in general, at the true gamma point of a cubic material, both guys are degenerate because the hybridization vanishes by symmetry. The confinement effect breaks the symmetry and therefore lifts the z squared up.
Right. So here we are sitting at 0, and I just go up in the z direction here.
Correct.
And confinement makes this thing forbidden.
Correct. Now, I would have thought that the amount by which you get lifted up is essentially just the hopping between the nickel and the apical oxygen. That is, I make that hopping stronger by bringing the apical oxygen closer. Right. I lift up the z squared more. As I make it weaker by putting it farther, I lift it up less. So why can't I just, by moving it close enough, push the z squared entirely above? You know, if I just make, if I increase the z direction nickel oxygen hopping enough.
No, because you cannot get.
Why can't I
push it all the way? No, so if you take this confinement, let's say where do you put the nodes, and now I'm going to put aluminum here or something.
Yeah.
So the naive thing you think you'd put a node in the wave function, yeah, this plane and that plane, that would tell you to go to here.
Yeah.
Yes. So you would get to this point, and then you could do nothing. But then I'm telling you, well, I mean, these are scattering links, yes, so they're not hard walls. By changing the chemistry of this, where the node is, can be changed a little bit up and down. And by trial and error, we did this proton. It actually turns out that you can get it pretty more here. So aluminum would do this, but the other one would do
that. I'm asking a slightly different question. If I now change.
The point is that it's not oxygen. Now you put this other guy here. And this guy, which is aluminum or scandium, speaks to the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So it modifies this oxygen level. So that's the point.
But I had a much more trivial question. There is a nickel to apical oxygen hopping, which varies in some way with the distance between nickel and apical oxygen.
Yes.
As I make the distance between nickel and apical oxygen less, just nickel and apical oxygen, forget about everything else for the moment, just move that oxygen down, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Then I increase the hopping between nickel 3z squared minus r squared and apical oxygen. Therefore, I should increase the scale of this splitting.
Yes.
And therefore, if I move the apical oxygen close enough to nickel, essentially independent of what else is happening, which will of course control how close I can move it, I should be able to lift 3z squared minus r squared arbitrarily up
that's
and just
right.
get it out of
there. And what is the limit to that?
You're
And the limit is, if you now move the oxygen closer, then the single dot, you will empty the 3z squared then. That means that, what am I saying? I'm saying nonsense now.
So I think that's all you have to do, right? You just want to find trick
no,
but that oxygen close, right?
That's right, but the material, you can't put your finger there. Yes, it has to do with that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this, yeah. No. Yes. I will not go any further on that.
So here, I have a question in this T-prime model. Right? So in the cooperates, the epsilon S level is higher than the epsilon the EF. So that's a T-prime has a different sign as the original T, right? So that's the Y T-prime has the positive and the T is negative. But when you here, you lift up the D3Z square mass 1 there, so your level essentially is upper the EF.
It's the wrong way. I mean, this T prime over T, I mean, I have this R parameter, all these epsilon S parameter. They are good parameters. The R is sort of a downfall. There's a power expansion. So let's say you can write your tight bang as a Fourier sum. Yes, you write the dispersion of the band as a Fourier series. And C and C prime are taking just the two first terms of the Fourier series. So I'm telling you, if you have the R value, all this epsilon S, you can write the whole Fourier series. But whether you can truncate it after two terms is another matter. So I mean, if you Fourier series, if you have two bands, you can't do the Fourier series because it's a one-band thing and so on and so forth. So I'm saying I don't call it T prime over T, not here because it goes.
I think this question was just about the sign.
The sign.
Yeah, but that's and then we're getting into the electron, the whole dope, and that's a different matter, I would say.
Wait, I got lost. So you're saying that in this material, the sign is opposite to whole dope cooperates?
In the cooperates, so we know that in the single band.
No, it's not.
Right, that whole dope is T prime negative.
Yes.
Are you saying that this is the opposite, or are you asking?
I'm asking.
Okay.
No. No, I will show you a picture of the fermion. Sorry, yeah. I don't think that. Okay, so we were at this point. So the point I wanted to make by stretching, and this is a lot, that is 12 and 4, that's whatever, 3%, and then it's a lot. You couldn't possibly move in more than that, and nothing much is happening. Remember, this proton was much better. Here, nothing much happened. Could again, this proton moved it up here. So this is really, really tiny. It's not very efficient because of that. And now,
how do plane bond lengths change after that stretching? I mean, if I compare for your left and right curves, what is the nickel to apical oxygen distance? How much does it change?
Oh, it changed a lot. It goes down to 1.8 something.
So there's a substantial difference in nickel apical oxygen resistance between those two, and yet the splitting at the gamma point doesn't change.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, yes. And the other point I maybe wanted to make, I mean, the span you see, the distance between the 3z squared at this point is huge. Lots of, so if you took the average of the band, just take the crystal field splitting between the two, it's changing a lot. But what matters here is what happens close to the Fermi surface. There, very little happens.
Same with like an overall doping effect, because it looks like the distance between the two points at the gamma point is somewhat different. It's just that, as it were, you shifted the Fermi level relative to the bands, but we should discuss that later.
Well, I mean, you had to calculate the volume all over the zone, not just along this one. Yeah. Okay, many DMFT, so we do this two-band DMFT calculation. So here's again the aluminum one, which is here, and the Fermi surface of this guy looks like this. And the coloring is the same, so remember here they don't speak to each other, so this thing should actually be absolutely black and this one should be absolutely yellow, and then out here they hybridize. So this part, this thing comes from the cuprate-like band. But we have this little nose, this little thing sticking down from the nickel. So that's a two-sheet Fermi surface, and this thing comes from the 3Z squared. So you almost got rid of it. But as you know, if you put on DMFT many body effects, you will of course tend to make it more of an insulator, so you make a crystal field splitting enhancement, so you actually do get rid of that one for a certain U. So this is now the DMFT calculation where we are cranking up the U. So let me say, so if U, and these are actually big values, so if U stays below 6.4 volts for these linear functions, you have two Fermi surfaces. You have this situation here. You have a critical U here at 6.4, and for that material, and to 7.4 in this window, you have one sheet, you have this thing. And that Fermi surface looks exactly like the highest TC that has an R of 0.45 or something like that. You've gotten rid of that. And if you get U above that, you get a mod, this thing become mod insulating.
How did you miss it in LDA plus U?
Sorry?
Did you look at LDA plus U?
Yeah.
The critical values?
U's are different because these are the U's you put on the Vanier functions, the LDA plus U, you have Bashkor, you have this or you have that, and it's a totally different matter. So we do everything as function of U. Yeah, it's not well.
Oh, so we can't directly compare the U.
No.
But presumably but it's not the critical U and
yeah, it is the same
U,
the same order of magnitude. Okay. Okay, so the Coulomb correlations enhance the crystal field splitting and simplifies the Fermi surface at one sheet once this thing goes above here. And the shape at the critical point is I equal to 1/2, like the cuprates with the high TC max. Yes, and this we had, all right. So this is just to remind you what happened to the cuprates. I'm back at a one-band model. The thing I just wanted to comment on, you might say those U values are pretty big. And there's this thing which you may not know, but what happens in the single band Hubbard model for the cuprates is how does the thing change with this value of R? So this is now the bands, an old calculation from Tanushri many years ago, 2.1 volt, and then I'm putting up to 3 volts. This is dope, we don't care. But the point is that, let's go through these. That to get the mod insulator, the higher the R, it's harder and harder to get those guys to be mod insulators. So with the R value, they are becoming more and more metallic, if you like. So as TC max goes up, a long shot, these underlying band structure is more and more metallic. So you need a higher, so whereas you get a mod insulator for the undoped thing, you can see how this goes. This guy here is almost metallic, or maybe it is metallic, the transition is between these two. And we were now going to this even higher R value, so it is not totally wrong that you end up with need quite high values.
The overall bandwidth doesn't change, basically.
No. Okay, this is just to say there's a J, that's just the two man. So J here is about the exchange coupling. It's a little bit bigger than the two frames.
The overall bandwidth that you want to compare.
Okay.
But presumably,
so the message I wanted to make here is that the MFT does less than chemistry. Sorry. in this case, yeah.
If you keep the bandwidth constant, but you change the just the shape of that band a little bit, so presumably that a critical U that drives you to Mott insulator would still be, you know, within the range of 3 electron volts. You might maybe need.
No, there's a paper even by Sanustri and somebody which got out in this rapid communication this year, something like that.
So she has the data for
I mean, here the bandwidths are the same, you just change the R parameter. And she was interested in the electron doped, but that's another matter. I think she has these values also for the undoped.
But if you want to compare it to the kinetic energy and not to the bandwidth, and that guy is changing.
Yeah. Yes, so what we were looking at here were the nickelates undoped. I mean, I have said nothing about, and this thing said that if you could have this situation, then even an undoped nickelate, if everything else were the same, could have been a high temperature superconductor. But you are, of course, also allowed to move things here by doping them down here.
Yeah.
So, all right. Okay, so now back to LDA plus U, all these instabilities. So this is just the bulk nickelate, and you remember all this that you can put in here. This is a lanthanum nickelate, but putting in smaller errors, you can get a zoo of different phases, charge tissue oppressionation, and this and that, because all these perovskites, they distort and do their usual business. We took the lanthanum, which is sitting up here, which is a paramagnetic enhanced metal, but these ones are insulators of various kinds. So now for the materials we did here, we are doing LDA plus U calculations over here. So this shows, this is the first one, the lanthanum aluminate. Then we put like some titanate in between all the layers. So here you have titanium instead of aluminum. It doesn't help very much, and these are very similar. And then we went to the yttrium scandium, where I put dysprosium. It's almost the same. That was a good guy that we had, where we had the scandium in between here. And over here now shown results of LDA plus U calculation as a function of U, and it's VASP. I put it from 0 and up to 7 volts. And what is shown are now the distances, the nickel oxygen distances in the plane, the x distance and the distance to apical oxygen. And the next level shows whether there's a gap, it's 0 here, and it shows whether there's a magnetic moment, which is shown here. So for this material here, the apical oxygen you can see is down to 190 nanometers, 1.9 angstrom, and this one is 95. And if you put U up to about above 4 volts, the thing just disproportionates. You get 2 nickel sites. So these calculations you allow for 2 different nickel sites. The other ones we couldn't do it. So you get a small nickel and a big nickel. So you get a D6 and a D8, and they happen to be ferromagnetic insulators. Ferromagnetic charge density rating for number 1. So this is charge disproportionation. And that it actually looks as if you were driven by U, which is a nonsense, and that's what I said. So we had some discussions about that. So I said, well, try to crank up the J and see what happens. And if you put a bigger J, not from the 0.75 canonical one to this one, you can see that that actually it comes earlier, and charge disproportionation happens earlier here. So I think it's all right. But there's a big problem with these standard codes, because the program doesn't, how does it count electrons? How do you know whether you have 6 or 8 or whatever? It doesn't know it at all. It sums up in some spheres, or it puts some atomic wave functions, or I don't know what. So with these standard programs, it is pretty ill-defined, and you have to take the results with a grain of salt, I believe. All right, so this one will, and experimentally actually it also does, but maybe for the beast. So that thing is no good. The philosophy of what we are doing here is we don't understand high temperature superconductivity in the cuprate, but we can do calculate. We can do all the calculations we can do for a cuprate, we can also do for a nickelate. And then we can see whether we get the same result or something else. And if we get the same result, maybe we should go along this direction. And that's all this guy, not surprisingly, does the same charge distribution. hallucination as this one, but our favorite guy down here does a very similar thing. That thing stays put, has a small set distance, and finally out here it does a antenna distortion, where they become lumps like this and that, but that happens way up here. But before that, actually it becomes an antiferromagnetic metal or insulator, and that's what you see here. And if I compare that, if you can see the thing, I've done the same for single layer. So this is single layer, this is our single layer mercury, so this is the cuprate with the high CC. If we do the same LDA plus U calculation for that guy, it gives you this line here, it becomes of course an antiferromagnetic insulator, and for this one here. So those two look pretty much the same. So at the moment we would say this is something that you might perhaps.
When you get this as it were charge density wave, right? Does something also happen to the relative occupancies of the two orbitals?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, because here...
Yeah, they have different moments of sequencing. I mean, they... it becomes...
I don't know how to compare small and large here. What I mean is, does the number of x squared minus y squared versus the number of 3z squared plus r squared, that relative amount of orbital polarization, does it also change at this transition? And more precisely, does it change between the two sites of the sublattice?
Right. Yeah, we should look into this. Of course, in plane, in the square theory, of course, there are no occupancy on the small subside on the D6, and on the D8, they are both occupied with one electron. What it is in reality, you would have, but that's again this matter of definition, how do you count electrons?
However you do it, LDA plus U presumably gives one some answer.
Yeah, I'll show you. There's a picture now. I just say Nicola is not here, but she made a big study of what it does in ferrates. But anyhow, so this is the big side and the small side. This is the charge disproportionation. And the other one with the antenna is probably this one. No, not quite. This is tilting. Well, there should be something somewhere. This guy here. Yeah. So, and we should probably do more, or somebody should do a study like this. Now let me do something. You could of course try to block it more. You could add more insulating layers. And that's what happened here. So here we have three insulating layers, here we have only one. And as you see, it becomes flat here, of course, because this insulating blocked it completely, but it stays down here. And so this one, it's really our favorite scan day. It's really now sitting above the Fermi level. It's even better than here because you got rid of this dispersion, KZ dispersion here. So that can be done and should be done, but something which is worse is, of course, they can't make single layers at the moment. It's not possible to make a perfect single layer. And if you put two layers if you get two layers, you of course have a lot of interlayer, bilayer splitting for the 3z squared, because it's easy to hop between the layers with the 3z squared, and you get this thing here. And this bilayer splitting maybe not so bad, but this is not so good. So that probably decremental. So one experimental challenge at the moment is certainly, but I don't think you can get down to one. But back to the old one, I think time is up, but there are people, I was in Japan, and Tokura is actually going back to the old 214 compounds, but the nickelates. And so why not do that? And you would say, because Anisimov and Weiss told you don't do it, because you can't do it, I'm not going to here. So I'm now back to not making heterostructures, man-made heterostructures, but asking why not the structure that Landstrom Carbox cuprate came in, because that thing has very little KZ dispersion, because the layers are not sitting on the top of each other, but they're shifted over like that. And maybe that would be enough. And people in Japan are trying to do that. They are not so. So that is D7, so instead of one of the lambda we put staunchion, like this is D7. And they had a calculation for that, and they of course concluded that you occupy the right tank single or whatever. So this is the oxygen band sitting here, and you get a huge splitting. They put on the AEV, the EG orbitals, the majority and the minority are split by AEV, and the seventh electron is now going to sit at the top of the oxygen P bands here, so this would be, this is no good for high. But nevertheless, experimentalists are now trying to put in various rare earths in here, and so we held them a bit and tried to do some calculations, and this now summarizes this. So these are the ones we talked about. So what I now put here, this number is the crystal field splitting. So that is the difference between the average 3z squared level and the x squared minus y squared. So it has nothing to do with the foot, but it's the average. So and here, so the 3z square band is sitting high on this 1.79 electron volts. And as we went, the worst one, this one from Titan, it went down to 0.17. It went down to 0.15. If you now come to the 214 bulk materials, and you take the old one, the Anisimov type, or the lanthanum strontium, it is way below. It is the 3z squared is sitting below. It's minus 0.14. And what Sakura and people are trying to get better, they put in neodymium, then it goes 3z squared, goes up a bit. And the newest one, I think, is europium, they put in, it goes up a bit. But in all these cases, the sign of this thing is the opposite. And that also means when we do DMFT or Philip Hansman does DMFT, the 3z squared gets occupied. You get rid of the x squared minus y squared, but the 3z squared gets half fooled, and the Fermi surface looks very different than they believe in Japan. They've seen it with Arpes, and it looks pretty much with like the dispersion we calculate for that function.
Is the Arpes?
Sorry?
Yeah. Is the Arpes?
I don't know what it's called. It has something. I can tell you. I have to pay. I don't know. Maybe neuronosis. No.
So out of this one heterostructures, you just told us.
These ones are the heterostructures. That's the one I talked about. Right. And these are the normal 214 materials, but with D7.
So out of the heterostructures, were there any made?
No, I don't know whether to. I don't know. That's. I mean, I was not there. Well, what I know about are these.
Heterostructures have been made with neodymium nickel, neodymium and nickel, and putting, I forget what the insulating, I think neodymium aluminate. And they've made 1, 2, 3, 4 something nickel layers. This is this character Jack Chakalian. For some reason, lanthanum is not a good thing, and it's people have not had very much success trying to get heterostructures built on lanthanum aluminate and nickelate.
As I said, I believe, I mean, Habermeyer is now, we have this dysprosium scanate and we're trying with that, but as I said, the problem is you cannot get single layer nickel in it, so. Yeah, so that's what I said with that, and we think various people. There was this one thing, so here are your, if you want to know what just for prediction does, I mean, the numbers are here, but I will not be able to get plus you. Yes, I think it is high time to stop. Thank you for your patience.
So we had already lots of questions. No questions to anyone.
So none of these nickelates are mock insulators in nature.
Oh, none of the nickelates are not, what's them, they're insulators, I don't know what they, you know, how do you measure it? They're insulators, yes.
And they're not insulators? Yeah.
Well, they have this charge disproportionation, right? You go away from lanthanum and they are insulators and they have two different nickel sites.
Yeah, but not only that, but at higher temperature they can be bonded and they become insulators.
I don't know, has anybody clarified the relation between the charge disproportion?
Yes, so those are insulators.
You mean here on the left?
Well, that's a magnetic measurement. The question is the charge disproportionation persist above T now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
More questions?